Welcome to the Talking Legal Ed podcast with Professors Linda Jellum and Billy Joe Kaufman. In each episode, we explore cutting-edge legal issues with renowned legal scholars and teachers. In these explorations, we discuss the legal doctrines implicated in the issues we tackle. But perhaps more importantly, we look at how legal educators can bring these issues alive in the classroom.
Billy Joe, it's so great to see you today. I am super excited. We have Barbara McQuaid, as you know, who is a professor of practice at the University of Michigan and also serves as a legal analyst at MSNBC and NBC News. And you can't miss her. She is out there all the time just speaking on every important topic, it seems, that we are facing as a country.
I listen to her mostly morning, noon, and night. And what I really love about it is she can take things that are so very complicated and make them understandable and answer the questions, not as if we're all experts in the law, but I just love her modeling for her presentation. So it's lucky for us to have her, and let's get started.
Excellent. And let's ask about her book. I understand it's coming out February 27th, so I'm excited to hear more about that.
Yeah, I've got a pre-order today, I think. So.
Excellent. All right, let's go. Well, Barbara, it's so good to have you on the show today. We thank you for coming on to talk to us here at Talking Legal Ed. We want to talk to you sort of about your many, many experiences and your book and all you're involved in with your MSNBC commentating. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started. And I think it would be really helpful for our listeners if you could talk a little bit about your background. You know, how did you get to teaching at Michigan?
Well, thank you both for having me on. Great to be with you and have a conversation about teaching. It's something that I really care about and I always work to get better at because I can't think of a job where you can have a bigger impact on society than in teaching. So I came to the profession late. You know, some people start early in their career as teachers, but I practiced law for almost 30 years before I went into teaching. After I graduated from law school, I served as a law clerk, served in private practice, and then spent most of my career at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Detroit, first as an assistant U.S. attorney and then as the U.S. attorney during the Obama administration. And then when that administration came to an end, so did my job. It was time to move on. And I was fortunate enough to land at my alma mater, the University of Michigan Law School, where I teach criminal law, criminal procedure, and of course, in national security and civil liberties. And I love it. It's, you know, the chance to work with students it keeps you engaged and interested. And, you know, if I can have some small impact on their ability to understand the law and help other people with their skills, I will have accomplished something very important.
Oh, wonderful. That's a wonderful background. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your time as the U.S. Attorney General for the Eastern District of Michigan. You had some interesting cases while you were serving in that role, as I understand.
I did. You know, I'm sure everybody who serves as U.S. Attorney has certain cases that are more memorable than others. All of them are important. You know, even cases that don't get headlines are important to the people involved, to the victims and the parties. But, you know, certainly a few stand out. Well, one, we prosecuted the former mayor of the city of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick, in a case involving embezzlement and extortion and theft and fraud and all kinds of things. It was a fascinating case, went to trial. He was convicted at trial and served 7 years in prison during a time when the city of Detroit was really down on its luck and about to go into bankruptcy. We had a case involving a doctor who was a cancer doctor who lied to his patients, telling them they had cancer when they did not, just so that he could submit large bills and provide chemotherapy treatments that they did not need. And he provided billing worth $34 million.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, just an awful case. He was ultimately convicted and sentenced to a lengthy prison term. But can you imagine anything worse than having a doctor lie to you about something as serious about as to whether you have cancer? And while they were relieved, many of them find out they did not have cancer. Many of them had suffered all kinds of side effects from the chemotherapy, you know, hair loss, loss of teeth, harm to damage to organs and nerves and other kinds of things. And then the third one I'll mention is the one that came in the door on the very first day on the job. I was confirmed as the U.S. attorney on Christmas Eve of 2009. And the very next day, Christmas Day of 2009, just as we had finished unwrapping gifts under the tree and the ham had gone in the oven, I got a message that an Al-Qaeda operative had tried to blow up a plane over Detroit upon its landing. And that, you know, they at the time thought firecrackers had gone off on board. Turns out it was a bomb that failed to detonate as designed, although it did cause a massive fireball on board, and the plane had to do an emergency landing. But he confessed to having been an Al-Qaeda operative, trained, tried to take down this plane that had flown from Amsterdam to Detroit on Christmas Day. And we were very fortunate that the bomb misfired and that the only person who was injured was the bomber himself.
Wow. So you don't have a whole lot of interesting cases to talk to your students about, it sounds like. just kidding. So where did you get all of your expertise in national security? Because a lot of what you've been talking about is, you know, your criminal background and your expertise in criminal. What about the national security piece of it?
Yeah, as an assistant U.S. attorney, right after 9/11, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Detroit, like many other offices, stood up its first ever national security unit. And I, you know, had spent so much time while I was home watching the attacks of 9/11. I was home on maternity leave at the time of the 9/11 attacks. And really, it seared into my mind the images and the victims. And I just wanted to do everything I could to help that cause and to protect our country. And so when that unit was stood up, I volunteered to join it and worked in that space for about 7 years and handled cases involving terrorism financing, threats, export violations, hoaxes, all kinds of things, including planning for special events from a counterterrorism perspective. So worked in that space and got a lot of great experience and training during that 7 year time post 9/11.
Barbara, I often listen to you going or coming from Mercer Law School, either on way too early or just this afternoon on Katie Tour. And I think our listeners would be quite interested in knowing how those opportunities become available. Today, I thought, wow, she knows about bankruptcy too. But I guess it was the criminal piece of that particular case that had some interest, or you would have had background or knowledge. So do you get a choice where you could say, well, thank you all very much, but I can't talk about that? Or are you just sort of on guard for whatever may come up and however they might need to use you?
Yeah, that's a great question, Billy. And it's the former. I mean, there are times when I say that's outside my area of expertise. You know, sometimes they want to ask me about antitrust law or civil matters that I don't know about. And they'll ask, you know, my wheelhouse really is criminal law or national security related cases. And, you know, which is pretty broad. As a U.S. attorney, you do handle not just criminal cases, but also some civil cases and also bankruptcy, because the United States has an interest in that. But today I was talking about opioid addiction, and that's certainly an area that we worked on when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office. But for your listeners who might be interested in getting into this space, there is a need for law professors to share their expertise with the public in all of media, press, radio, television. And it's an expertise that I think the public cannot get enough of, because our world is so complicated. And it's very useful, I think, to have law professors to explain. And the goal isn't really to give your opinion. It is to help break down complicated issues and explain to people what it is you can do. And I think that media outlets are constantly looking for people who have areas of expertise. And so to the extent people are interested, they should reach out. There are, you know, media agents who will represent you and pitch you to various news organizations, or you can reach out on your own and just let them know that you have a particular area of expertise. And I think they welcome it because, you know, the news covers everything. And when they do, they want to report the news, but they also want to analyze the news and help people to understand complicated issues, to break it down. And that's where experts can come in handy. I think one thing that is a natural fit for someone who's been a trial lawyer is the skill set of taking a complicated issue and making it understandable to ordinary people, because that's what trial lawyers do for juries. You know, juries come in and they have to learn about some area of the law they've never learned about before. But I think anybody who's a law professor does that every day with their law students, trying to take complicated issues and synthesizing it in a methodical way so that law students can understand it. So I would encourage any law professor with an interest. You know, I think that, you know, just for example, where I am a contributor at MSNBC, they like to have a deep bench of a lot of different contributors who can come on. They want a lot of different voices. They want diverse voices. And that's because the variety of the topics is so broad, and the time of day, they need people 24/7. And, you know, not everybody's available. There, many times they'll reach out and I just can't do it because I'm in class or, you know, teaching, or I have some other conflict. So there are a lot of things that go into it, but they like having a deep bench. So to the extent your listeners are interested, I'm sure that expertise would be welcome.
Is that how you ended up getting involved with MSNBC, that you reached out to them? I assume they reached out to you. You have a little bit more of a pedigree than many of us coming into law profession.
Well, it was on my first day as a new employee at the University of Michigan Law School. I was actually at new employee orientation, and I got a call from MSNBC to go on. It happened to be the night, I don't know if you remember this. I follow this stuff closely, so I remember it well, but Sally Yates, who had been the acting attorney general for just a little bit of time, was going to be testifying before Congress that day about her conversation with the White House counsel about Mike Flynn's involvement with Russia. You know, he'd been recorded talking to Russian diplomats. And so she was testifying about all that. And they were looking for somebody who was familiar with the Justice Department, with criminal prosecution, and with national security. So that happened to fit my wheelhouse. And so someone had recommended me to do that. And I said, sure, I'll give it a try. And I did that. And then the very next day, President Trump fired Jim Comey as the FBI director. And so I got asked back to talk about that. And then, you know, once you do it a couple of times and, you know, you do a decent job, they asked you back. And so one thing led to another, and I became a contributor there.
And for the good or bad, there's a lot of opportunities to talk about.
Yeah, right. That's right. You know, we live in such unusual times with so many unusual issues. You know, currently a former president charged in 4 criminal cases and several civil cases. There's no shortage of things to talk about. So, yeah, it's a good opportunity to explain the law. But unfortunately, we find ourselves in some very troubling times.
Are you tired of the word unprecedented?
Yes. Although, you know, it's hard to find another word that matches the same thing. I read that, you know, that was a word that should be retired because it gets used so frequently. But it has been a truly unprecedented time. And, you know, sometimes people suggest that actions are unprecedented, but that's because circumstances are also so unprecedented.
So it's also very political, which can be difficult when we're entering into a law school classroom. If our politics enter, whether they actually enter or not, sometimes isn't even, you know, sometimes they're perceived to be entering. And imagine in your situation, there's sort of an expectation that you have a political viewpoint given the commentary. You know, you're doing it for MSNBC. How do you manage that in the classroom?
Yeah, I really try to steer clear of politics, but, you know, that doesn't mean you don't from time to time criticize people who are political actors who are violating the law or allegedly violating the law. And I suppose one could argue that there's a political consequence for talking about charges against former President Donald Trump for violations of the Espionage Act, for example. But I also think you can't ignore that. And so we've been talking about that case in class. We talked about the seditious conspiracy case about January 6th in class. We talked about the election interference case in class. And so I think focusing on the allegations and focusing on the law is a way to steer clear of politics. And as I said, in both what I do with MSNBC and what I do in class is really trying to explain and discuss the law and the application. And sometimes it's useful to raise hypotheticals that frame an issue in a way that might be favorable to people on the other side of the political divide. You know, imagine if these issues were being used in favor or against another party. You know, you have to think about it in both ways so that you're not focused on punishing your political opponents, but enforcing the rule of law in a way that will stand the test of time, no matter who it's applied to.
You mentioned all of this, and we know you're in the process of writing a book. How's that coming? Where's that project at?
Oh, thanks for asking about that. The book is in, the next thing I need to do, it's now getting, you know, printed and distributed and all of those things. And it comes out, will be available February 27th, though available now for pre-order. the very next thing that's going to happen is that as soon as our law school goes on break, I'm going to use that time to record the audiobook. I'll be the narrator of the audiobook. So that's be over a number of recording sessions. So I'll be doing that during the break. But it's the book is called Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. And I look at both the history of disinformation and the tactics that are used and discuss how it is harming our society today in terms of public safety and national security, in terms of democracy, and in terms of the rule of law. So it's been fascinating to learn more about it. I offer some solutions, but mostly I just want to raise awareness and invite a national conversation about our duty to each other, to truth and facts. If we're going to govern ourselves, we have to have an allegiance to the facts before we can even begin to discuss our opinions.
I feel like there are two questions here. One, do you really think all sides are willing to get to the facts, one might say? And I don't know if that question is answerable, but I think that the more sort of baseline question I have is, what led you to this? Why do you think that perhaps you can make a difference to the discourse that's going on today, which isn't very productive? Why a book?
Yeah.
Hey, congratulations, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, first to your question about, is America ready for truth? I don't know, but that is a challenge. And I think I try to appeal to our patriotism that we need to. And I agree with you that I think there are some people who have been duped. And I think public education is a big part of getting past disinformation. But I also think that there are people out there willing to perpetuate the con because they believe that it's in their political or personal self-interest. You know, tribal signaling by saying things online just because you want to be in one camp or the other is definitely part of what is going on. You know, people who are election deniers, who absolutely know better, is part of the con. And so I think that we have to call people out, even when, and maybe especially when, it advances our side of a political issue. We need to call out disinformation and falsehoods and lies and focus on facts and truth so that we can govern. And then why a book? Because I think this is such a critically important moment. It's something that I teach in my national security and civil liberties class. I started teaching it in 2016, after the 2016 election. When I first started teaching this class, we looked at the Mueller investigation and about how Russia was using social media to drive people apart and sow discord, you know, by posing as people online that they weren't, posing as Americans, pushing, you know, not only disinformation about Hillary Clinton, but also pretending to be, there was, you know, an account called Heart of Texas that pretended to be Republicans in Texas. There was one called Tennessee GOP that was pretending to be the Republican Party in Tennessee. There were others called Blacktivists pretending to be African-American activists or United Muslims of America pretending to be Muslims. And they would go on there and, you know, rile people up saying, you know, don't go to the polls. Hillary Clinton has taken you for granted. Don't vote. The way you can speak volumes and represent your interests is by not voting. And so just trying to suppress the vote, all of those things. And then we saw an evolution of Americans getting involved in this with the Stop the Steal movement that culminated in the January 6th attack. And so as a national security practitioner and scholar, I'm very interested in this weapon and how it exploits our freedoms, especially, you know, free speech in America, one of our most cherished freedoms. And now this freedom is being used against us as a weapon. So I find it fascinating, but I also think that I'm hoping that by raising awareness of it, we can blunt the harm of this weapon that is currently being used against us.
So if you had, you know, you said you have some solutions in the book. If there's one thing you want our listeners, who are mostly, besides my parents, you know, law faculty, what would you say to them? What is the one thing that they should be doing either in the classroom or in their scholarship or in their service, whatever the leg of the stool would be? What is the one thing that we all can do to improve our discourse that we have right now going on?
I think the most important thing we can do is to engage in civic engagement. you know, one of the great hazards of the past few decades has been our seclusion. And our seclusion got even worse during COVID-19, which is why I think we have reached such epidemic proportions of where we are in terms of polarization in society. But there's a great book, I cite this in my book, you may have read, maybe you both are familiar with, called Bowling Alone. And it's about how in the 1980s, the author Robert Putnam said we were becoming so polarized because he blamed it on the advent of television, that we weren't joining, you know, the Elks Club and the Kiwanis League and scouting and Little League and all these kinds of things that bring us together, even, you know, labor unions and faith communities, because we were all home watching our shows. And with the internet, it's become worse. You know, we have relationships with people we know only online. And during the pandemic, of course, we were all shut in. And so it allows you to live in a very small world, and it allows you to believe these stereotypes about other people. But when we're out there and we're engaged, whether it's in universities or faith communities or labor unions or bowling leagues or whatever it is, you meet people across all strata of society. You meet people who are wealthy and less wealthy, who are of every race, who are of every age, who are of every religion. And you realize the fundamental truth that we all have more common than we have differences, that we all want the same things. We want, you know, health and prosperity and security and a better life for our children. And so all of these things about how, you know, the left and the right want to do these awful things to you and eat your children are not true. And it helps you, I think, to dispel a lot of this disinformation. So I think a healthy society really needs us to be out there engaging with each other.
So let's talk a little bit about, I'm sort of backtracking here. You said you came to law teaching only after 30 years of practice. And what, and I know at Michigan, you're sort of in a special role. What is it? A professor of practice, if I remember the title correctly. So what do you think about that? What do you think about someone, you know, coming out after they've put so much time in sort of going through the real world, so to speak, and coming into the classroom? What do you bring that's different than, say, someone who comes out of Harvard or Yale, clerks for a year, and then boom, ends up in a law position, law teaching position?
Yeah. So in Michigan, we have this professor from practice position. We've got maybe a half dozen of us now, maybe a little more. And I think it's becoming more and more prevalent at various law schools around the country. And, you know, we'll never replace the academic legal research scholars that you just described, you know, brilliant people who have devoted their lives to research and really digging deep and understanding issues and shaping the law in a really important way. But I think there is a great role for people who are professors from practice like me to complement what they are doing. One of the things we bring to the classroom that maybe is a little bit different is that practical experience. And so, you know, when we're talking about issues in the classroom, I am able to share with students stories that maybe point out how difficult it can be to apply some of these issues in real life. You know, maybe some of the ethical dilemmas that lawyers face. I often will have hypotheticals where I put them in the role of being a lawyer. You're a prosecutor, you're a defense attorney, you're a judge. You represent a victim, and, you know, asking them to put on those shoes for a minute and think through a legal issue. And so I think, you know, having lived and experienced, you know, I start class every day with a little lesson about something I wish I'd known when I was in law school. It's usually some practical tip of, you know, some mistake I made along the way. But, you know, I think 30 years of practice and mistakes, if I can help prevent them from making the same one, well, I'll have provided a valuable service, I think.
That's a great suggestion. I know people that do the song of the day or other ways to start the class. Maybe you had this feeling when you were in law school. We've talked about this with several of our guests. These major big things are happening. I remember Robert Bork was being nominated. That's how old I am. So, and sometimes we either are able to integrate it and it works and it's fine, or we don't talk about it at all. And somebody, you know, goes out in the hall and said, wow, you know, X happened. And professor, nobody said anything about this. How do you walk that line of when you just feel that you have to talk about whatever happened 2 hours ago?
Yeah, I think we live in a time where there's an expectation that we're going to talk about what's going on in the world. And it's different really from when we were in law school. I too was, you know, in law school in a time when we really just focused on the law and we didn't talk much about what was going on in the news. But I think the internet just brings the news into our faces in a way that's different. You know, I could go about my business. Maybe I'd glance at a headline, but I was living it as a pretty cocooned, sequestered existence as a law student. And now with social media and the internet and, you know, 24/7 news feeds, the students are really up on the news and they're really curious. They yearn to hear. They want a perspective. They want some framework for thinking about some of these kinds of things. So I think we talk about them. You know, some of them are really complicated, like, and some are beyond the scope of my class. So in criminal law, for example, it seems that every semester there is some high profile police shooting, tragically. And the students, you know, they're upset. They want to hear about it. They want to learn about it. And so I think the classroom is a place where we can recognize that pain, help people feel seen, and also talk about what the law protects and maybe vulnerabilities that exist in the law and have a conversation around that. But, you know, by providing them with, here's what the law says on this issue, they have a framework that they can use to try to process results that maybe offend their sense of justice. Sexual assault is another one that comes up from time to time in high profile cases that students are very curious about. And then there are other things that might be on the scope of the class, but I think it's important to acknowledge. For example, you know, the conflict in the Middle East right now between Israel and Gaza, it's something that really is beyond my capability of explaining in any way in my class. But I do just want to, I've acknowledged, like, I know some of our students are really going through some pain right now, anger, frustration, hurt, and some have loved ones who are at risk or have suffered. And I just want to acknowledge that, you know, our community is going through a really difficult time right now. So I don't know if that's the perfect way to deal with it, but I think gone are the days when we can just sort of ignore what's going on outside the classroom and say, today, we're just going to talk about, you know, the doctrine. I think applying it to current events is really important.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I think the events going over in Israel and Hamas are really difficult to bring into the classroom, given that there, you know, are two viewpoints on it, and I certainly don't know enough to have any a strong opinion one way or the other, and so it's a little, I will not lie, a little scary to me to bring something like that in. But on the other hand, as you say, you know, it's definitely likely affecting some of these students in ways that we don't even know about, and so by not bringing it in, you know, you're sort of ignoring that background. I know that I have heard you say in another situation about how important you think it is for the U.S. to be the democratic leader of the world, and that we lost a lot of that after 2016, I guess I would say during the Trump presidency. I don't know if we've gotten it back or not under Biden, but what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. And I discuss this in my book, some of the harms to democracy. There is, you know, evidence that I have cited that following 2016, when there was election interference in the election of Donald Trump, those who were sowing discord online celebrated with a champagne toast. Now, I don't know whether they did or didn't change the outcome of the election, but they sure tried. And then in 2020, when we had the election and claims that the election had been stolen that resulted in the attacks of January 6th. Again, an episode where there were anti-democratic forces around the world that celebrated and used that as an opportunity to say, see, we've told you democracy doesn't work. Democracy is a failed experiment. Even our new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has said, democracy is two lions and a lamb discussing what's for dinner. And I think it's a really frightening thing to suggest that, you know, what we really need is wise elders to tell us what to do and to tell us what to think. You know, democracy is something we have safeguarded for centuries in this country. And we've been a leader in democracy on the world stage. According to our own State Department, democracy is something we strive for around the world because of a belief that democracy stabilizes the world, that democracy stabilizes currency markets, that it helps us to have allies, it avoids military conflicts, it leads to alliances and treaties and better care for the people around the world, which reduces refugee crises. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons that democracy is good, not just for the United States, but it's good for the world. And I think when we've got our leaders saying democracy doesn't work, or the vote has failed, stop the steal, sowing doubt into our electoral process, that is damaging to our country, and it's damaging to the world when we're not there to be that beacon of leadership in democracy. And I think it's one of the reasons we're seeing democratic backsliding around the world.
You know, it's interesting. I suspect at Michigan, but many, many law schools now are doing programs with the students on civic education to go to the junior highs or the high schools and really teach about the importance of democracy, about how a bill becomes a law, you know, basic street law, because a lot of folks don't really know. And I'm not sure it's apathy. It's just, it's not covered the way it used to be covered in elementary school and junior high and high school. So those efforts are parallel with a different audience for us to teach students that we normally wouldn't teach. But I think the students that are in those programs have learned a lot, both about the importance of democracy, but how to teach that to a younger set of citizens.
Yes, that's incredibly important. I know some of our students and I have participated in the American Bar Association's Law Day programs at middle schools, talking to students about the Constitution on Constitution Day, talking about various, you know, they make it easy. They put together little PowerPoint programs, you know, so if you're not terribly confident, and it's a wonderful thing, because really anyone who's a law student or lawyer can do it, because they put these packages together in ways that are easy for students to understand, but you're there to help them to answer their questions. And I think it is critically important that we get out and teach it. You know, we say we ought to teach these things in schools, and I agree with that, but you know, schools have challenges because there is so much that they are required to teach in terms of, you know, depending on the state, teaching to standardized tests and other kinds of things. But it is something lawyers can do, is say yes to these opportunities to teach. Often it's just 1 hour in a school, an elementary school, a high school, a middle school, with prepackaged programming. You know, look out for the ABA that have these programs. And it's really fun because the, you know, students are curious to learn. You know, it's sort of a special day off for them when, you know, a guest speaker comes in and they're curious. You can really make a difference in a kid's life who's also curious about the law and maybe has never met a lawyer before and can learn about what it takes to go to law school. And you can give them the confidence and maybe, you know, spark some excitement for someone to have a career in the law. But if nothing else, you know, a class full of students can learn a little bit about being a good citizen.
So it takes us all back to your book and your goal here of making sure that we understand disinformation. So let's get that information out one more time for our listeners, the name of your book, and then I'm sure you'll share with me the place that people can pre-order, and we'll put that in our show notes.
You're so kind. I will provide you with a link. But again, the book is called Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. It comes out February 27th, but available now for pre-order.
There you go. You haven't said that once or twice before, but thank you again. I don't want to take too much more of your time. It's been such a pleasure, and always we truly enjoy listening to you whenever you show up on any show, because you do have that ability to take something and make it, simplify it down for your audience, whether your audience be us, whether your audience be the public, or whether your audience be your classroom. So thank you for showing up here on Talking Legal Ed today to show that to us.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks so much for listening. We look forward to speaking with you again in our next episode of Talking Legal Ed.
Talking Legal Ed is produced by David Ritchie in association with Panopticon Media. Editing by Tim Spieshock and artwork by Kaylee Jellum. Please look for all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts.